Hello, I'm delighted to say that this episode of Film Stories is sponsored by NordVPN. Now, if you're unfamiliar with a VPN, it is a virtual private network, and it's a service that basically allows you to pretend that your computer or device is in a different country. So you set a virtual location for your device, and that means that suddenly you can get access to things that otherwise you might not be able to see. So for instance, if you're a Netflix subscriber, you set your NordVPN to America, then you get a plethora of options from American Netflix rather than UK Netflix, which is where this podcast is based. You can do this with all sorts of things. You switch the virtual location of your VPN service, and then you get access to TV shows, to films, to sporting events, streaming services and such like that you just wouldn't be able to get from the UK. A quick mention too for the cybersecurity features of NordVPN, including shielding your online activities, encrypting your connection, and using threat protection as well. To take advantage of this, you need to go to nordvpn.com/filmstories. That's nordvpn.com/filmstories. And you can try it risk-free with a 30-day money-back guarantee to get the best discount off your NordVPN plan. If you go to that Film Stories link, that will give you an extra 4 months free on top of the 2-year plan. And again, there's no risk with Nord's 30-day money-back guarantee. And you will also find the link in the podcast episode description box. Hello, this is Simon Brew. I'm the editor of Film Stories magazine, and a very warm welcome to the Film Stories podcast.
Sorry about that. I literally had to fly in from outer space.
Come with me.
And I show you how deep the rabbit hole goes.
In movies that have stories.
That the story just sucks them in.
This is just the beginning.
Stories. We would be honored. Join us.
Hello and a very warm welcome to Film Stories with Simon Brew. I am Simon Brew. As always, that's absolutely everything you need to know about me. The aim of the podcast, though, well, it's given away by the title. I'm here to talk of the stories of film, and I tend to talk about production stories, development stories, release stories, marketing stories, all the ingredients, really, that go towards making the films that we know and sometimes love. Just that, the films that we know and sometimes love. The films I tend to cover on this podcast lean more towards the mainstream than anything else. They're films I'm interested in or invested in to some degree. I try not to do snark. I try not to punch down. This podcast is a celebration of cinema and a real appreciation, really, of just how hard it is to get a film off the ground. Now, if you're new to this podcast, two quick things. Number one, I cover two films in every regular episode. And number two, I keep the preamble light. So I'm going to get on with the first of the two. Let me take you back to 2015. I'm going to play you a clip from a trailer of a comic book movie. And I'll come to the story of it the other side of this.
Dr. Storm, we gave you 6 years and millions of dollars, and you gave us nothing. What's different now?
Reed Richards. He knows answers to questions we don't even know to ask yet. This is our chance to learn more about our planet and maybe even save it.
I want you to meet my daughter, Sue.
You want to be famous?
I just want my work to make a difference.
Johnny, Reed.
This guy doesn't take orders well.
Yeah, especially from people who say, I don't take orders well.
Don't let any of these lab coats give you any crap, all right?
Well, if I do, I know who to call.
The Muscle.
I gotta say, it's fun having you here.
Really?
No.
What you've created here is incredible.
You guys sure you're in the best shape to be doing this?
Yeah. We're good.
They just cracked interdimensional travel.
Incredible.
That then was a clip from 2015's Fantastic Four, directed by Josh Trank, with the screenplay credited to Jeremy Slater, Simon Kinberg and Josh Trank, based on Fantastic Four by Stan Lee and Jack Kirby, and starring Miles Teller, Michael B. Jordan, Kate Mara, Jamie Bell, Toby Kebbell, Reg E. Cathy and Tim Blake Nelson. So the tale of this particular Fantastic Four film, well, let's go back to 2005. Let's start it there, because that's when 20th Century Fox first debuted a Fantastic Four movie, a PG-rated, softly received film based on the much-loved Marvel comic books, directed by Tim Story. That film did decent money, and the cast of it was duly signed up for three movies anyway. It wasn't doing Batman and Marvel levels of money, but it was still okay. And so it pressed ahead with the sequel in 2017, Rise of the Silver Surfer, and that also did okay money. But at the point that the box office grosses of other comic book movies was going up, Fantastic Four was a little bit flat. I've covered Rise of the Silver Surfer on a previous episode of the podcast. And so that cast was signed up technically to do a third Fantastic Four film, but Fox decided it wanted to try hitting the reboot button. That the rights to the characters that it had acquired off Marvel meant that it had them in perpetuity as long as it kept making films. And so if it wasn't going to do a third film with the 2005 cast, it needed to do some kind of reboot, which is exactly what it decided to do. So it was in August 2009 that Fox made that decision and hired Akiva Goldsman to produce and Michael Green to write a new Fantastic Four movie. Now, by the summer of 2010, I mean, it didn't need an announcement to the former cast. Their option just wasn't picked up for a new film. But the reboot was well underway, and the website Screen Rant, in its pre-clickbait days, was reporting that Bruce Willis was being chased to be one of the key parts of the new film, playing Ben Grimm or The Thing. Kiefer Sutherland also in contention and on Fox's radar for that role, unsurprising given that Kiefer Sutherland had become a huge asset to 20th Century Fox for starring in the TV show 24. There were also, in 2010, three possible directors who had been talked about. Joe Carnahan had just steered the A-Team movie to the screen for 20th Century Fox. I've covered that on a previous episode of the podcast. I've also covered V for Vendetta, and its director, James McTeague, was being talked about. And then David Yates, coming to the end of his initial run on the Harry Potter films, he was a contender. Oscar winner Adrian Brody was set to head the Fantastic Four and potentially play Reed Richards. Alice Eve, meanwhile, had reportedly turned down X-Men First Class so that she could keep her schedule open so that she could play the Invisible Woman or Sue Storm. And then there was Kevin Pennington, who was in the frame as Human Torch Johnny Storm. The thinking was actually, because Fox was making X-Men First Class around the same time and had been auditioning a lot of actors for that, that there was some kind of crossover, that actors who weren't quite right for the X-Men film but stuck in their mind were possibles for the Fantastic Four movie that the studio was looking to make. The projects were working in relative tandem at this point, and the idea was that Fantastic Four would film in 2011. It would be in cinemas for the summer of 2012, and a sequels would follow thereafter. But it was all looking a little bit ambitious if you don't have a director on board. And in 2011, it was a different film that changed the course of this Fantastic Four film a little, because a brand new young film director burst onto the scene with some style as well. His name, Josh Trank, and he was in his 20s when he made the fan footage superhero movie Chronicle, a really smart film, a low budget film that he'd been able to make away from the glare of people, really, and with a degree of creative control he wouldn't ultimately get on Fantastic Four. And he delivered for Fox a number one box office hit. I think to this day he is the youngest director to have a number one box office hit in the US. And of course, a brand new up-and-coming director who delivers a hit out of nowhere, well, very much on the Rolodex of studios for other big projects. This was the era where, I mean, we were just coming into the era where independent directors were just being plucked and given big blockbuster movies. And so, I mean, Josh Trank was being linked with Venom for Sony, for instance, a film called The Red Star for Warner Brothers, the video game adaptation Shadow of the Colossus for Sony and PlayStation was also something that he was considering at that point, apparently did a bit of work on. Yet, of the projects that were being offered to Josh Trank, it would ultimately be, as you can probably guess by the fact we're doing a podcast on it, Fantastic Four that bobbled to the top of the pile. As such, in July of 2012, 20th Century Fox hired Trank to direct the film, and alongside him, Jeremy Slater came on board to work on a script. Some script work had already been done by Zach Stentz and Ashley Miller, who'd been working on, wouldn't you know it, X-Men First Class as well. But there was a slight difference of direction coming between Trank and Slater, that Slater was pushing towards something a bit more Avengers-y style for the film, that kind of feel. And Josh Trank was looking for something a lot darker and a little less in the style of the superhero films at that point. Now, Slater would tell Polygon that he, in the end, left the project just 6 months after he'd been hired, that he'd penned 18 drafts by that point, but only a couple of them had made it to 20th Century Fox. And as Slater said, right from the start of the process, Josh told me I wasn't allowed to speak to Fox without him present. And so he said he never saw 95% of the notes that came back from the studio. But the studio had hired Trank. They wanted his brain, they wanted his vision. And so that's kind of the way it was heading. When Slater went, though, Fox did bring in some of its more regular, its regular personnel, that Simon Kinberg, even though at one point he said he was kind of a bit superheroed out, he was persuaded to come back for Fantastic Four. He'd done an awful lot of work on the X-Men films. He would direct X-Men Dark Phoenix for Fox in the end. And he came on, and between Kinberg and Trank, they worked to fashion a screenplay that was working. It was heading in the right direction. The problem was, as the film got close to production, there still wasn't really a working third act to the film, something that would kind of haunt it right up until months before the film was ultimately released. Now, this didn't mean that things weren't pressing forward, that the casting of Fantastic Four could get underway, that Michael B. Jordan was very high on the list right from the start in one of the key roles in the film to play Johnny Storm. Miles Teller was someone that Trank was particularly after. Kate Mara was someone who came from Fox. Apparently, Fox was keener for her to take on the role in the movie. And Jamie Bell rounded out the key quartet of the movie. Depressingly, there was some pushback against the casting of Michael B. Jordan as Johnny Storm because of the colour of his skin, and some people on the internet did not take that very well at all. Trank would report receiving death threats at one stage over the casting of Jordan in the movie. I mean, an actor as brilliant as Michael B. Jordan, it's quite terrifying really that it leads people to that level of just sending threats by the internet. I mean, I could say more on them there, but I just don't really want to give him the oxygen. Instead, I'll turn to the casting of Doctor Doom in the film. That there were a few people in the running for that, names such as Eddie Redmayne and Donald Gleeson. I think Sam Riley was mentioned at one point as well. And in the end, it would be Toby Kebbell who would be cast as Victor Von Doom / Doctor Doom in the film. Apparently, Mads Mikkelsen auditioned for the part as well. However, the casting was pretty much in place, and Fox had allocated a production budget of around $150 million. It wasn't absolutely at the high end of where all of this of where superhero films were at that point, but was still expensive, although there was said to be a cut in that budget just ahead of filming, which I'll come to shortly. Quite a lot of pre-production work inevitably was being done on the film, and an awful lot of previs as well, and the pre-visualization of some of the action sequences and the big effects scenes in the film was something that Trank really hadn't had to do on Chronicle before, and he was pushing back a little, according to the report over at the Polygon website, and feeling really that the pre-visualization wasn't capturing the feeling of the action scenes that he was after. So he was really pushing a direction that he wanted this film to go. And on May the 5th, 2014, production could finally begin on the Fantastic Four movie. This was nearly 3 years after Trank had signed on the dotted line to direct in the first place. And I mean, 1 month later, he landed to what was likely to be his next project, that he was signed up to direct a Star Wars movie for Lucasfilm. It would have been a Boba Fett film. He didn't, in the end, make that film. I'll come to that slightly later in this particular story. The main shoot of Fantastic Four ran for 72 days in the end, and from the outside looking in, there was little sound of drama to it, that there are a few bubbles here and there of it was a slightly difficult production, but how was that out of the norm of many blockbuster films of that particular time? There were stories though that popped up afterwards that were pretty brutal, I think it's worth just acknowledging, and they were aiming a lot of fire at Josh Trank, that he was I wasn't on the set. I don't know what happened, but Josh Trank seemed to be the person who was attracting the ire, the person who was sent out to take all the shots, really. And there were suggestions, for instance, in the trade press that he was quite isolated, that he was erratic on set, that he hid himself away behind covers looking at monitors. And then, I mean, Trank would just point out, it's just like, you can't, sometimes you go and look at the video. It's just like people have different perspectives on what one human being could do. A story would appear after filming as well about him and his dogs causing $100,000 worth of damage to a house that he was stopping in. And again, this was just repeated as gospel without really Trank getting a chance to have his say on any of this. On the shoot, I mean, it's worth noting that Trank was still in his late 20s at the point this was shooting. And a director who was going from a relatively small film to a big studio blockbuster. And there were producers, Hutch Parker and Simon Kinberg, who were said to have been on set and around the shoot and just offering some degree of protective shield around it. There were stories of unhappiness as well between Josh Trank and one of his lead actors, Miles Teller. But again, this felt like tittle-tattle, that even to this day, they're the odd little story that seems to come out, but nothing of particular substance to it all. But because there was so much mud that was being flung, an awful lot of it in the end really kind of stuck. One thing that is certain is that the death threats got to Josh Trank, that he was aware of the vocal minority who were protesting about the casting of Johnny Storm. And I mean, it got to the point where Michael B. Jordan would pen an essay in Entertainment Weekly magazine. And in that, he would echo that Stan Lee, the co-creator of Fantastic Four, had endorsed his casting in the film as well. But Trank would say that he was getting threats on the IMDb message board saying they were going to shoot me. And so he kept a loaded gun on his nightstand during the making of the film, and he would only return the gun once production was over. He would say in an interview, "I was so, what does that say, clucking paranoid during that shoot." He said, "If someone came into my house, I would have ended their clucking." I think that says life. And he says, "When you're in a headspace where people want to get you, you think I'm going to defend myself." And there was kind of a feeling, you get the sense from Trank's words, of someone who was being attacked and very much in the line of fire. Trank would also say that Fox chopped the budget fairly late in the day by some $30 million just ahead of production, which meant scaling back some of the things they wanted to do in the third act of the film. And so that was, again, going to cause problems once the movie was in post-production, which I'm coming to shortly. But as Simon Kinberg would reflect to Entertainment Weekly, I mean, he said in an interview there, "Was it an easy production? No. Was it harder than a lot of the movies I've been on? No." But he just said, "I may also have a higher threshold." He says, "I think there was something about Josh's identity, this young director breaking through, that made him a good target." And he says, "I'm not sure what that is." Filming nonetheless wrapped end of August 2014. Fox was already planning a sequel as well, that it was going to announce a summer 2017 release date for Fantastic Four 2, that this first Fantastic Four movie was going to be out in the summer of 2015. And so that gave Trank time to go off into the edit room, and he came out the other side with his cut of the film that was screened for 20th Century Fox executives. And it would be fair to say that 20th Century Fox executives were slightly spooked by what he presented to them. They were reportedly not happy at all with the film that was in front of their eyes, that the tone of Josh Trank's Fantastic Four was said to be quite dark and quite uncomfortable. There's still elements of body horror to the final cut of the movie that we ultimately get. And that wasn't what Fox was after. Fox was looking at the money that Marvel films were making, $1 billion in some cases. And it kind of felt, certainly the implication again, that it needed to follow the path that Marvel was set at, not the path that Trank had gone down with this particular film. It's worth noting that Trank had been on this movie for 3 years at this point. The tone that he wanted to take it would not have been a surprise to 20th Century Fox. I can't imagine it didn't have eyes all over the production as well. But still, when it saw the cut, it just didn't like it. and there was no real ending to it, reportedly. The final act problems hadn't been fully sorted, and the studio knew very quickly that it was going to be ordering up some reshoots on a film. Now, again, I said many times on this podcast, stories of reshoots on films are nothing new at all. Lots of films have reshoots. Only some of them are reported as problematic. In the case of Fantastic Four, Fox brought in more writers that Trank apparently never met in the end. And so he was said to have eventually had a chat with the producers, just enforcing the fact that he had certain rights as part of the Directors Guild union. And so Trank did a deal with Fox whereby he would do a re-edit of the film that he'd put together, and Fox and its executives would put together a version two. And to that end, it brought in another editor, a man called Stephen Rifkin, who'd worked on Avatar. And Rifkin was said to be working on Fox's version. Trank would continue to work on his. The idea then was you put both cuts in front of test audiences, you see which is the winner, and you release that. Although that didn't really seem to happen, because by January of 2015, reshoots were being put together based on the cut that was being put together by Stephen Rifkin, not the cut that Trank was doing. So Fox was ordering up these reshoots, I was planning these reshoots as well, which Trank would have to go along and shoot, but not based on the version of the film that he was making, that the energy and focus of Fox was going into, if you like, the Rifkin cut of the film. Now, Josh Trank still reportedly completed his edit of the film, but it's no spoiler to say that has not seen the light of day at this point. Meanwhile, while all this was going on, finally, the lid was coming off stories of a troubled production. Now, again, this is not uncommon. If you go to something like World Wars Z, for instance, I can't call it World War Z after all this time. That was a hit movie for Paramount Pictures, made $500 million. But the press in the year leading up to its release was horrendous. The whole story about how the last third of that film was basically completely reshot. And so people went to see that expecting a disaster. Certainly quite a few critics did, I believe, went expecting a disaster. And they got a perfectly decent film that went on to be a hit. So the fact that there were stories leaking into the trade press that Fantastic Four was a troubled production. Well, it's interesting to read, but that doesn't necessarily suggest the film you're going to get at the end of it is a problem itself. But it got to a stage, I mean, there were various things that just poured fuel on this particular fire, one of which was in April 2015, it was revealed that Josh Trank would not now be directing his planned Star Wars movie, that he would be stepping away from Lucasfilm. As it's worth noting, other directors did as well. I mean, Colin Trevorrow's an example there, who's making Jurassic World films. He was supposed to be doing a Star Wars film, ultimately didn't do a Star Wars film. Stephen Daldry was supposed to be doing a Star Wars film, ultimately didn't do a Star Wars film. There are lots of stories now of directors who signed up to do a Star Wars movie who didn't. Trank's misfortune here was he was one of the, I think he was the first to step away. And again, the poison pens were out in the trade press as well, that the rumour mill was suggesting Lucasfilm had been a bit spooked by stories of the production of the stories of the Fantastic Four production and shoot. And it's why it chose to go in a different direction. It didn't, in the end, make a Boba Fett film. The extensive reshoots on Fantastic Four took place, and these were clearly problematic. You only have to see the final film to note that they're problematic, that they're quite wiggy. Miles Teller, Kate Mara, Michael B. Jordan had commitments. They'd moved on to other films at that point, so were having to come back and try and adopt the visual guise, the characters that they'd shot like 8 months before, something like that. That it wasn't just the actors who had other commitments. That Hutch Parker and Simon Kinberg, they were supposed to be off doing X-Men Apocalypse with Bryan Singer, crikey, and so they came back from the set of that to be on the set for Fantastic Four and the reshoot work that was taking place in April 2015. Trank, by the sounds of it, was kind of going through the motions there, that he was on the set, but how much of it he was directing and how much was being moved around by other people on the set is unclear. You can imagine the unhappiness of being in that situation, that he'd been working with his own editor, Elliot Greenberg, who'd worked with him on Chronicle, but the version that Fox was clearly going with was not his. that the reshoot footage that was taking place affected the back end, the final act of the movie. And again, it's not hard to tell when you see the final film. Still, Hollywood PR and marketing departments, PR departments in particular, are good at trying to douse the flames a little bit. And so out came Trank and Simon Kinberg doing a side-by-side interview in the Los Angeles Times, published in June of 2015, what, 6-8 weeks ahead of the release of Fantastic Four, just talking down the drama, really. And Trank would gamely do press for a film that had, in his eyes, been taken away from him. And I mean, it was just heading to release point, and then the infamous moment really that really painted a target on his back, that he posted a tweet, what, a day or two before the release of the film, back when Twitter was called Twitter, remember that? And he posted, quote, "A year ago I had a fantastic version of this and it would have received great reviews. You'll probably never see it. That's reality though." Now, he deleted it pretty soon after that, but he'd broken the secret code of Hollywood in that you don't wash your dirty linen like that, that studios do not like things like that going out a day or two before the release of the film. And it's one of the things that I would imagine affected studios working with him in the aftermath of the release of Fantastic Four, because now the knives were absolutely out for him. And in the aftermath of him penning that tweet, the Hollywood trade press dug into a lot more the actual filming of the movie, and the blame was being put very squarely on the shoulders of its director, fairly or otherwise. He'd made himself, by tweeting that, an easy target. I mean, apparently a few days before, he'd emailed the cast and crew thanking them and telling them how proud he was of the film, but here the narrative had completely changed. And so the film was, I mean, it was held back from critics for quite a while, and it went in front of the critical audience and landed with an absolute thud. It's fair to say it landed with an absolute thud. It was not a popular film. The reviews were borderline hellish in some cases. That I still think there's things of interest in this Fantastic Four film. I do think it takes a slightly different path to the superhero movies that were around at that point. There's the body horror stuff. There's stuff in like the first two thirds of it that's actually quite interesting before it becomes something a lot more generic. But still, I think even its most passionate defender would suggest that it's not the finest of its ilk that was coming out around that time. It's quite interesting that Trank, on his Letterboxd account, went back to the movie a couple of years later and reviewed it himself, found things to like in it, but conceded it's not a great film. Again, it wasn't fully his film, but it wasn't a great film. So it went then in front of audiences, that the quoted budget was $120 million. It was released in the US the weekend of August the 7th to the 9th of 2015. And it opened in second place with a $25.6 million opening weekend. Now, that's not awful by the, you know, just in isolation, but certainly in the context of superhero films, it was on the low side. The Ant-Man had been in cinemas for 4 weeks at that point, was still in fifth place, $150 million in the bank just in the US. That there was also, I mean, this was the summer too that Jurassic World just made $2 billion, that Avengers Age of Ultron had overcome not great reviews itself to make $450 million in the US, $1.4 billion worldwide. And there were films making an awful lot of money. On its opening weekend, Fantastic Four was beaten to the top spot by Mission Impossible Rogue Nation, which was on its second weekend of release and took $28 million on its second weekend. The wonderful thriller, The Gift, actually, which I'm coming to on a future episode, also opened the same weekend. And this, from Joel Edgerton, this is an outstanding thriller. $11.8 million opening. And I think it's Jonathan Demme's final film, Ricky and the Flash, was also out that weekend. And that fell a little bit short commercially at $6.6 million. The problem for Fantastic Four, though, was that the word of mouth was out now. And it wasn't just that the knives were out, it was the fact that the audience was not, as they had done with Avengers movies, coming back for a second view or anything like it. It lost nearly 70% of its audience on its second weekend. Now, there was stiff competition. Straight Out of Compton was a hit, but I don't think many people saw it was going to have a 60 million opening, although perhaps they would have done if they'd looked closely. But that was a mid-August hit that was a very pleasant surprise for Universal Pictures, that it turned into quite the juggernaut it did. The Man from U.N.C.L.E. was released the second week that Fantastic Four was out as well. That took 13.4 million. Guy Ritchie's film, which has a lot of fans, that I'm very aware it has a lot of fans, but that fell short commercially as well. For Fantastic Four, inside 3 weeks, it was clinging on at number 10. And that was, I mean, there was no way of buttering that up. That was an underwhelming performance at the box office for the film. By its fourth week on release, it was down in 13th place, and its US gross would top out at $56 million, an international gross of $111 million, and so worldwide $167 million, far less than the previous two Fantastic Four films that Fox had done, and the commercial performance of those had led Fox to reboot in the first place. This was, I mean, the sequel was fairly quickly cancelled. It's worth noting that as well. There was no way that that cast and the director were going to come back for a 2017 movie. And Trank, I mean, he's given interviews since that he came back to the screen in 2020 with a film about the final year of Al Capone's life called Capone, starring Tom Hardy, that he put 2-3 years of his life into, put his heart and soul into again. And it's only really when that came out that he was openly talking in interviews about his Fantastic Four experience. And I mean, for instance, he said to Variety, in the 5 months leading up to the release of Fantastic Four, there were numerous stories in the press that described a person who had the same name as me, Josh Trank, who was allegedly a mess of a person, just destroying these movie sets, getting involved in all sorts of embarrassing situations. He said, I'm reading about this person who has my name, except I don't remember any of these stories the way that they've been told to the public. He says, my first reaction at the beginning was to feel very defensive and to want to defend myself. And then he said, when I realised I couldn't defend myself against the way I've been characterised, I just had to sit there and spectate. He would reflect that when basically he was in the middle of the situation, it was very clear that everybody was doing the wrong thing. And when the stories started to come out, I was the designated fourth guy. One nice story he did share was that the late Stan Lee was in touch with him after the release of Fantastic Four to check he was okay, wrote him a letter and just checked in on him, which he clearly didn't have to do. But this would be really for Fantastic Four, for the way Fox was approaching comic book movies, a bit of a line in the sand, really, that the sequel was duly cancelled in due course. And then while Fox was working out what do you want to do with Fantastic Four, Disney came in and bought 20th Century Fox's parent company, 21st Century Fox, and thus by 2019, Fantastic Four was now back under Disney, was now back under Marvel. And at the point that this podcast is being recorded, we've just had an announcement of a new Fantastic Four film that's coming out in July of 2025 with a brand new cast. It will be 10 years after the release of Josh Trank's movie. In that time, Trank has made one more film, hopefully more on the way, because the man who made Chronicles still has an eye. There's still filmmaking in him, but it kind of the most I'd probably say the most infamous box office disappointment in the world of comic book movies and superhero movies of the 2010s. And a film that, for which its director, again, for right or wrong, for better or worse, was made to carry the can. Which brings me to the halfway point of this latest episode of Film Stories. And as always, thank you so much for your time and thank you for listening. I'm just going to do a few parish notices before I talk about, well, Fantastic Four. So firstly, if you like this podcast and don't mind supporting it, there are a couple of ways you can do so. If you're keen to financially support us, God bless you, then if you go to patreon.com/SimonBrew and put a bit of money in the tin there, you get the podcast early. You get it ad-free pretty much every week. You also find out the gossip of what we're up to behind the scenes, and little tidbits end up going in there. Costing you absolutely nothing, meanwhile, is to subscribe to the podcast at your podcast home of choice. That's massively appreciated. Likewise, if you can leave, ideally, a hugely positive review, that is also massively appreciated. And then if I can just do a quick plug for my Film Stories print magazines, that Film Stories magazine is 168 pages. It's film magazines like they used to, huge, chunky, real thud, really nice paper. We're really proud of it. The current issue is talking an awful lot about the new Bob Marley biopic, One Love. I'm working on the issue after at the moment. There's so much coming up in that. If you go to store.filmstories.co.uk, you can find that there. You can also find Film Junior, which to my, as I understand it, is the only print film magazine of its type. That it's a film magazine for under 15s that's also written in part by them as well. Again, hugely proud of it. Independently published, store.filmstories.co.uk. But now I'm going to move on to the second of the two films I'm talking about in this episode of Film Stories. And it's no spoiler to say I'm doing Fantastic Four again. I'm going to play you the full trailer for this because it gives a flavour of a film that pretty much nobody has seen. I will come to the story of it the other side of this.
From the pages of the world's greatest comic book adventure, four heroes on a daring mission in space, but something went wrong. Genetically transformed, they become the most powerful superheroes of all time. Forces of evil are out to destroy their cosmic power.
Find them!
And to survive, they must utilize all their strength. To put an end to their arch nemesis.
Doom? It's clobbering time.
The Fantastic Four.
So that was a released trailer for the film The Fantastic Four, dating back from 1994, directed by Ole Sassone, screenplay by Craig J. Nevius and Kevin Rock, and starring Alex Hyde-White, Jay Underwood, Rebecca Starr, Michael Bailey-Smith, Ian Trigger, Joseph Culp and George Gaines from the Police Academy movies. And so, I mean, ordinarily I end these film stories by just going through the box office takings and assessing the commercial performance of a film and all the little details like that. The Fantastic Four from 1994 made nothing, zero, not $1, not £1, not 1 cent, at least not officially. Because this was a film, as you may or may not know, that never actually saw an official release. So let's go right the way back to 1983 to start this story, which was when a meeting took place at the home of Stan Lee, the co-creator of Fantastic Four. Now, Stan Lee lived in Los Angeles, and a German film producer by the name of Bernd Eichinger, who had, I mean, he produced films like The Neverending Story, went to visit Stan Lee at his home and went looking for an option for a film of Fantastic Four. So this was 1983, and already at that point the rights were not available. The reason the rights were not available was slightly odd. It wasn't because the Fantastic Four had been optioned for film, it's because one of the characters had been. That an executive at Universal by the name of Frank Price had taken out an option on one of the four, the Human Torch, in 1977, and that option wasn't due to lapse until 1986. And so Bernd Eichinger, and he'd made his riches as CEO of New Constantine, a hugely successful German film production company, was going to have to wait if he wanted to get his hands on the characters. Now, he was a huge Marvel fan, and so he was particularly keen to do so. And so he bided his time And in 1986, he went back to Marvel seeking an option, the screen rights really, for the Fantastic Four characters. Now, in 1986, Marvel was in a very different place than it is today. It was selling the screen rights to its characters for really small amounts. And just to give you some context on that, in 1985, it reportedly sold the screen rights to Spider-Man to Columbia Pictures, now owned by Sony, for $225,000. Now, that deal that led to the screen rights being sold to Columbia would be one of the reasons Spider-Man rights would be so knotty and so stuck in limbo for so long. But to this day, Sony has the screen rights to Spider-Man films as long as it keeps making Spider-Man films. This was during the fire sale era of Marvel, where it was selling screen rights to its characters and its properties for just pitifully small amounts of money, thinking, well, at the very least, it will give us publicity for the comics we're trying to sell. So the rumour was that when Eichinger went to Marvel to get the Fantastic Four rights, he paid $250,000. Now, the deal that was broken meant that he had to get a film moving. And Eichinger knew that for the scale of the film he was looking to make, he was going to need some studio backing. I mean, he had some resources himself. But also, I mean, this was not going to be a cheap film to make. I mean, it was going to be, what, in the region of $50 million, he figured. And the thing is, in the mid to back end of the 1980s, there weren't that many movie studios particularly keen to put $50 million into a superhero film. That, I mean, was it Rambo 3 cost $65 million and at that point was the most expensive film of all time? So this was not a cheap project. And also, comic book movies and superheroes were not box office gold in the 1980s, at least not until the end of. I mean, we're in the era of the Howard the Duck film, covered on a previous episode of the Film Stories podcast, and a notable box office flop of the 1980s, a film that to this day, is whenever it's talked about, seems to have the words box office bomb next to it. Never mind the fact it's come out on 4K disc and been remastered and still seems to keep selling. It would be 1989's Batman, though, directed by Tim Burton, backed by Warner Brothers, that demonstrated to movie studios just how much money a superhero film could make. But that wasn't an awful lot of use to Eichinger at this point, because, I mean, he was running out of time. It got to the point where the option on the Fantastic Four was due to run out in December 1992. Now, you'd think in the aftermath of Batman that there would be some willing people to write a check. But don't forget, in 1990, out came Disney's Dick Tracy film, another comic book superhero, if you like. And that film was, even though it wasn't a loss, it wasn't a failure, it cost an enormous amount of money and didn't really bring in a lot of profit to Disney. And the feeling was that a superhero film was not by definition box office gold. It was going to take a few more films to prove that. And that level of waiting around wasn't something that Eichinger really had in his corner. He knew he had to have a Fantastic Four movie shooting in December 1992, else the rights were going back to Marvel. So if you imagine the amount of time it takes to write a film, to cast a film, to direct a film, the pre-production, ordinarily in normal filmmaking, he would have had to have most of this locked by the start of 1992, ideally beforehand. And when he started talking to Marvel about extending the rights to Fantastic Four, the answer he was getting was causing him headaches, because Marvel was making it clear at this point it had no intention of extending the deal. And so from Marvel's point of view, it got into like the middle of 1992 with no sign of a film being made. And so it could plan to have its rights back by the following year. However, Eichinger, it would be fair to say, pulled something of a move. One of the most infamous moves in this area of cinema. The kind of story that I think I've only really seen once. I've seen it tried to be emulated, but only one person has ever seemed to fully do it. So in September 1992, he realised he was running out of time and he just had to get a film made. He had to get something going. And so he put in a call to a man called Roger Corman. Now, cinephiles will be well aware of Roger Corman, a man who was notorious for micro-budget movies that gave people like Ron Howard, Robert Zemeckis, Jack Nicholson, James Cameron their first break. The deal with Roger Corman was, I'm going to give you next to nothing to make the film. We're going to make lots of films a year, but you can have a degree of control. This is a good place to cut your teeth. And he had an unbeatable reputation in Hollywood for making films both very quickly and, crucially, very cheaply. For Bernd Eichinger, he needed both of those. And so he rang Corman up, and Corman was intrigued. And over the course of a weekend, he put together a budget and a schedule of how he could get a Fantastic Four film in front of cameras before the end of the year, 3 months away. He figured he was going to need $1 million to do it. And the plan for Corman was, he knew that this was going to need a lot of prep. Costumes had to be brought together. The character played by Ben Grimm would involve some degree of special construction of a costume. There was something, I mean, the suit at the very least needed to be made. There would need to be special effects in this. There would have to be something, because what they didn't want to do is put across the idea that they were just doing this for the hell of it. And so Corman suggested they do not start filming until December the 31st, 1992, the very last possible day they could start shooting so that Eichinger could hold on to the rights. Now, he bristled at that thought. He just thought that looks a bit too obvious what he was up to. And so his counter suggestion was December the 26th, Boxing Day, we'll start filming. I mean, Corman's argument was, they're going to realise what you're up to anyway. I mean, if you're leaving it as late as that, so you may as well buy as much time. And so they compromised in the end, and filming would begin on December the 28th, 1992. Now, this did not give Corman a lot of time at all. He needed to crew up. He needed to cast this. And so he landed on a director, a man by the name of Ole Sasson, the son of Vidal Sassoon, no less. Now, he'd worked with him before on the film Blood Fist 3, Forced to Fight. And, you know, Ole was a big fan of Fantastic Four already. I mean, he leapt at the chance to do the film. But this was very much going to be foot to the accelerator stuff. I mean, there are stories of how the production design team went along to, it's the old cliche, isn't it, went along to the comic book store, bought up loads of comic books of Fantastic Four. Why do you want all of those? We're doing this film. And then all of a sudden they're swamped. You're doing it properly. Yeah, oh yeah, 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 yeah. And they really wanted to get it as authentic as they could within the very obvious parameters that they were dealing with. The cast weren't being offered a lot. I mean, the budget wasn't much. They were reportedly offered $3,500 a week for their work. It would be 4 weeks of work as well. Auditions underway very, very, very quickly. In came Alex Hyde-White as Mr. Fantastic, Rebecca Starb, Sue Storm, the Invisible Girl. Jay Underwood had taken the title role in 1986's The Boy Who Could Fly. Well, now he was the Human Torch. And then ex-US footballer Michael Bailey-Smith was cast as Ben Grimm / The Thing. And then on the 28th of December, as promised, Roger Corman had the film up and running, had it shooting. And so the box was ticked. Eichinger could hold on to his rights to the film. Corman was shooting this at his Concord Studios production facility in Venice in Hollywood. This was something he'd bought at the end of the 1970s for $500,000. And the stories were, he never really massively did it up. The roof was still leaking. The buildings were not on the luxurious side. And even though he would eventually sell the facility in 2001 for a significant profit, he was using it apparently to make films right up until the sale was complete. And again, not exactly tarting the place up to attract the films in the first place. The shoot, it's worth noting, was really quite ambitious, especially given the resources that they were working with. That there's a lab being blown up. There's a spaceship crash landing in there. I mean, Stan Lee came along to the set a few times as well. And even though the look of the film was inevitably on the cheap side and effect shots had to be reused, they, for the actors and for the creatives, they were giving this their all. They were making a Fantastic Four film that they fully expected to see released. In fact, the publicity got got to the point where a film magazine, Film Treat, put it on its front cover. I mean, there was the build-up of some degree of hype, and in early 1993, production on the film wrapped up. I mean, it was done by the end of January 1993, and so at that stage, it was into post-production. Now, post-production took notably longer than the shoot itself, and they, again, they put heart and soul into this. It was edited by a man called Glenn Garland. That the music was done by David Verst and Eric Verst, and they stumped up themselves apparently $6,000 so that they could, when their score could be recorded by a 48-piece orchestra for everybody working on the film. This was, I mean, it was a cheap film. They knew they were working with Roger Corman, but still, this was a film that was designed to be seen, and no one thought that it wasn't going to be seen. In fact, at one point, a release date was mooted. Labor Day weekend in the US in September of 1993. That's when the Fantastic Four was going to hit the big screen. And so pre-publicity began. There was that Film Threat article. There were trailers that started to play. Actors took it upon themselves to do some interviews to promote the film. Clips were shown at that year's San Diego Comic-Con. I mean, that was when San Diego Comic-Con was a much smaller deal than it is now. But even so, people were not being shy about the fact that the Fantastic Four was coming out. Even when the release date moved into 1994, a world premiere was scheduled for Minnesota in January of that year, and the build-up could begin and the promotional duties were getting underway. And then things came to a juddering halt. And this was not particularly pleasant stuff, because actors, instead of getting a phone call explaining to them what was going on, they received cease and desist notices to stop them talking about the film. And as per the story told by Bernd Eichinger, he was called up by Avi Arad. Now, Avi Arad was then at Marvel, and he offered, reportedly, allegedly, however you want to frame it, to buy the film up for several million dollars. And from Arad's point of view, he just wanted to bury it. He feared that this cheap-looking film, in his eyes, would denigrate the comic books, that would take the emphasis away from them, that wouldn't generate sales, it would take sales away. And so what this gave Eichinger was, first of all, a profit, and secondly, allowed him to maintain his option. He'd fulfilled his contractual obligations, and so he could continue to develop a Fantastic Four film. Arad, meanwhile, just wanted the negative, and just wanted it. He wanted it gone. He didn't want the film out there. The actors were said to have been devastated when they got the news. And it's only then, really, that rumours started to bubble up of a secret plan, that the idea all along had been not to release the film at all. And, I mean, it just seemed to fit. There was some logic. That there was a rumour that came to light many years later that in 1994, as Arad was buying up the negative, Eichinger was talking to Chris Columbus, who'd come off the back of two Home Alone films at that point, to do a new Fantastic Four movie. In fact, in 94, a deal was actually struck at one stage, reportedly, with Columbus to develop and direct a Fantastic Four film. That script work got underway. Columbus would drift away from the project. Sean Astin was linked with directing at one point. He's got an Oscar nomination for Best Short Film Director, actually. Peter Segal, who would go on to do, what, the third Naked Gun film and Get Smart, he was linked at one point. It was said got to a point where in 1996 that pre-production was getting underway on, let's just say, a more expensive version of Fantastic Four. That didn't happen either. But it never shook the suspicion that was unconfirmed at the time that this particular, the Fantastic Four, as it was called, had gone into production with the people behind it, the people ultimately behind it, having no intention of it ever being seen. And it was being described as a gambit by which the rights could be held onto. Now, it'd be about 10 years later that Stan Lee would suggest that that in fact was the actual plan, but Roger Corman and Bernd Eichinger both refuted the account. I mean, they argued, why would you stage a premiere? Why would you set that up? Why would you pay for a trailer? Why would you pay for publicity to go out? And so there was no definitive answer given to that. But Stan Lee would suggest that the plan was not to ever release it, but that the actors hadn't been told, the director hadn't been told, you know, the writer, the crew just basically hadn't been told. And in fact, in a historic interview, Roger Corman would many years later reflect that it was the strangest film production I've ever been involved with in my life. The film then was, I mean, it was done, it was completed, but there was no way, it seemed, it was going to be seen. There was no way it was going to be distributed. It just disappeared. Well, you know, the world has funny ways of getting you to see things that you weren't ever allowed to see. And so the movie basically has leaked out ever since in bootleg form. Think of it like the Star Wars Holiday Special, about how Lucasfilm tried to completely cover that up, and then enough bootlegs went round that it kind of bit the bullet in the end and let us see it. But in the case of the Fantastic Four, I mean, you'd go to conventions and someone would have a copy of it, would hand it over. When the internet came along, that was it. I mean, you no longer needed to get some kind of bootleg video or something like that. You instead, it's even as I'm recording this today, it's not tricky to go onto something like YouTube and you can find the Fantastic Four complete film. There were some reviews that did crop up, that one or two people, even at the time the film was ostensibly buried, had managed to get hold of it, and the reviews were just not massively positive. You'll be surprised to hear that the let's just say the shoestring budget shone through, as several critics noted, although there was said to have been a little bit of a charm to it. And even though the production values were really, really low, I mean, again, no way around it, there was the feeling that, well, you may as well put it out there. It's worth a look. There is at least something to it. And if anything, the film almost enters some degree of mythology, that it was more famous for not existing than it ever was for existing, to the point where a documentary movie came up about it called Doomed, The Untold Story of Roger Corman's The Fantastic Four, which that was released in July 2015, ironically around the time of Josh Trank's Fantastic Four film came out. And on that documentary, the cast came in, Roger Corman came in, and they talked about the film. They talked about the release of it. And it's almost like the iconic comic book movie that virtually no one has ever seen, certainly not legally seen, that it was seen as a really just a move by a producer. Whether that was ultimately true or not, it was seen as a move by Bernd Eichinger, who would, in the end, I mean, he would get what he wanted. That by when the Fantastic Film movie came around in 2005, guess his name was on the producer credits. There he was, next to Avi Arad and Ralph Winter. That he'd gone and chased, this Marvel nerd had gone and chased these rights in 1983, not been able to get them. He'd gone back in 1986. 5-6 years later, he'd overseen, he'd ordered a film that no one was allowed to see, all building up to the fact that he would be the producer when a Fantastic Four movie officially came to the big screen in the first instance in 2005. The irony, of course, is that I would suggest over time there's more curiosity and there's more interest in the 1994 film that he didn't release than the 2005 film that was a decent hit, but that he would release. How about that? Which brings me to the end of this latest episode of Film Stories, a rare venture into comic book movies for me there. As always, thank you so much for listening and thank you for your time. If I've not bored you completely, you can find more from me on Twitter at Simon Brew, on Blue Sky at Simon Brew as well. Film Stories is on Twitter at Film Stories, is on Facebook, Film Stories Online, on YouTube, youtube.com/filmstories, and the Patreon again is patreon.com/Simon Brew. If you go to store.filmstories.co.uk, that's where you can find all of our magazines and Blu-rays for sale. We have the UK exclusive Blu-rays of Sneakers. Oh no, that's sold out. Of No Way Out with fresh Film Stories extras on, and Bull Durham as well. I've done a special extra on that too. That's all at store.filmstories.co.uk. And just at filmstories.co.uk, that is our website. We update it every weekday with games, TV, movies, news, features, reviews, mischief, terrible jokes, and today, as I'm recording, a picture of a rabbit as well. How about that too? I think I've outstayed my welcome. I always outstay my welcome. I just leaves me to say thank you again for listening. Thank you for your time. I hope you all stay well, and I will be back soon with another bunch of film stories. Until then, look after yourselves. Bye bye.